Mae Warren, and I'm continuing with James Whitehead on the 3rd of October.
And she's worn out from all of this stuff.
No,
anyway,
I'm not. I'm getting more excited.
So I sat there and listened to him, and then he started talking about all of this. I didn't know what Chinese export meant. I didn't know what Lowestoft meant. I didn't know what, well, I may have known what Meissen was, but all of these other names were as foreign to me as if I were in another world. And suddenly, finally my eyes adjusted to the surroundings. And I was in a room, really, this is pretty close to the size of the room. It was not quite this wide. I'm in this chair, and he's on a daybed over there. There's a grand piano between the foot of his daybed with the keyboard pushed against the front window. Nobody could get to it to play, and there's an old black and white television set sitting on it and a telephone, and those were the only two things in the room that indicated that he was in the 20th century. There was a light bulb hanging from a wire in the center of the room, and there was one little table lamp, and there I was sitting with this man I'd never seen him before. There was a desk next to me, a full top, one of those that just at an angle that you open up to. But then there was a chest of drawers. But by his bed was the telephone, and then a bookcase that's over in the bookcase secretary that's over in the Morris house. And I could see in the next little room was what had been the dining room, was a hospital bed, all piled with books and so forth, and a dining room table with medicines and open cereal box, and that's all I could see. But as he talked on about Washington and Lee, and he said, I've made reservations for lunch at Carr's. Well, that didn't mean anything to me, but I was so happy to think that we were going to get out of there. I said, fine. So we go outside and parked at the sidewalk where the cab had been. It was this long black Cadillac sedan, almost like a limousine. And Joe, the handyman, had opened the doors for us. We got in, he put a lap robe on us. Suddenly, this was the only sign of affluence that I had seen. We get in there, get in the car, and he says, I've invited Anita Hinckley to have lunch with us. He, in the meantime, had told me that Mrs. Reese was sorry that she couldn't join us because she had not been well and was in a nursing home, but he expected her home any day. I said, well, I'm sorry she can't be there, too. So we get in this car, drive back to one of these great streets, and turn in an alley, and there we're in the back of one of these mansions. And coming out the back door of this mansion was Mrs. Hinckley, who was a tall, at least had to be 6 feet tall, all in black with a cape all the way to the ground and a walking stick. A lady now in her 80s. Joe, the handyman, goes and meets her and brings her out to the car, and we're introduced, and she says, oh, I love Washington. He said, my daughter was there for your fancy dress ball once, and we stated that she remembered every detail of fancy dress ball. Well, that made it easier, made you feel so good. We go to Carr's tea room, and they talk about porcelain and art. She was a collector as well. I listened to him and I knew nothing about what they were saying, although it was a little lady's lunch with a little tiny serving and I was hungry. But anyway, but what was so great, when this car pulled in the back and Joe gets out of the car and goes over and picks her up and brings her back to Lee, she gets in the car, the three of us are sitting on the back seat. All of a sudden, without even starting the car makes a 180-degree turn. I'd wondered how we were ever going to get out of that crowded back lot. Well, it was on a turntable. And I found out just recently, within the last month, that those were used for carriages. Back when people had carriages and horses, that was the way they turned the carriages around.
Oh, my gosh.
But I thought, my Lord, what kind of place is this to have that? You know? Well, I was more impressed with that than I was impressed with the porcelain. So after lunch, we go back to her house, and she shows me through these great rooms. Her family had been in the house for three generations, and it was a mixture of all of the periods from Queen Anne, Chippendale, Federal, right on up to the present day. But it was great. So it was an enjoyable meeting. And then we go back, get in the car, and it turns again on that thing. I'm so excited about that. Go back to, and the car pulls up in front of the house next door to Mr. Reese, which is a brick house, the one you see in picture. And that's when he said, would you like to see our little museum? And he opens that door, and it was so dark and so cold, there was no light, heat, or anything in that building. They had lived in it when they first married and then filled it up and had to move next door. And then he kept putting stuff in it, or they kept putting stuff in it. Here was, there was not an aisle. I had to step over pieces of ceramics along the floor and around furniture. He kept talking about all these things that I didn't know what he was talking about. So dark in there, he's got his little flashlight. We go to, he takes an oriental, what would it have been, a hanging off the wall, and behind that wall was a steel door like you'd find in a bank. And he evidently had to use a combination to open it up. And here, when he opened it up, we're standing right there, right, out rushes this pin-up, I don't know what it would have been called, atmosphere of something that has been cold and damp and night for 15 years just suddenly rushes out, you know, so happy to escape being in that little, and it was a vault. And the vault was about, again, around half of it that was, that we looked into was about half of the size of this room. Then there was another steel door that went into that room, but the first steel door he opened made this groan and a terrible noise. It was just like, it was just in great pain. Then behind that were two more little steel doors, metal doors that he had them. He put his flashlight in there, and here was this table stacked high with dishes. He said, that's a plate that belonged to George Washington, that's a set that belonged to Paul Revere, and that was, and he kept doing that. And he said, don't you want to go in and see them? And I thought, I've never seen this man until today. All he has to do is for me to get in there and slam that door, and nobody will ever know whatever became of Jim Whitehead. So I said, well, thank you, and I put one foot inside the vault and then kept my hand on the steel lock on the outside, and he explained. Then we closed it up and left, but that house had not been touched in 18 years except to add to it. So that was exciting. Going into the room, I noticed on the wall a painting of an old lady, and I thought that was Ms. Reeves, because Joe had whispered to me, I don't think she's coming home, she's an old woman. And I thought, well, that must be a picture of Ms. Reeves. And then there was another one just like it in the little dining room in that house. But it turned out to be Aunt Lizzie. And so, on the train back to New York, well, I went back and had dinner with him in this little dining room in his house, and he pushed all of these open silver cereal boxes and medicine containers to one side, put two Willoware plates like you get at the dime store, then a jelly glass, this is no exaggeration, I had a jelly glass, he had a jelly glass. He said, Jim, Joe has prepared us some supper, and he said, would you like a drink before dinner? And I could hardly talk because the dust from that other place was so great. God, that was awful. I said, I certainly would. Well, he brings out a bottle of Manhattan Mix cocktail, that syrupy, sweet stuff. Nothing that he didn't put anything in it. He had been, had a problem at some time in his life, probably when he was at W&L with alcohol, but that's all he had. To him, that was having a drink. And he poured some in my glass. And then we had little pieces of sliced country ham that he had left over from Christmas, some biscuits that Joe made, and some beans. And here we were surrounded by silver porcelain art, and we were eating off of dime store plates and drinking from jelly glasses. But that didn't, this didn't bother him in the least. He was oblivious to anything around him. They never let anybody clean because they were afraid they'd break things. So, and they would have. So then I get a call, a cab, and I go back to the station, and all the way back to New York, all I did was write down phonetically what I had remembered he'd talked about that day. And then I asked an alumnus of ours, Jim Martin, and his wife, Teen Martin, who was on our board of trustees. Jim had been a classmate if they were ever going to be in that part of the country, and they said, well, they were going up for their goddaughter's wedding in June, July, I forget. I said, would you go by and tell me if what I've seen has any merit or value? I said, I think it's a treasure. And they go up and visit with him. They send me a telegram saying, it is a treasure. And it was. They recognized what they were looking at. So then we started working with him, and what was it? The original thought would be that it was going to be at Cal Alto. You know Cal Alto, the big house here. I had an architect here at the University, Hank Ravenhorst, draw up plans. And I sent those plans to him, and for almost 3 years, he worked with placing every object where he thought it would go. It added years to his life. There's no question in my mind about that. And then one day I got a call saying from his lawyer, saying Mr. Reeves was in the hospital. He'd had a stroke, and then a few hours later he'd died. And we went to, and he said, Mr. Reeves would like to have you come to the funeral. And we went up, and we met her then after 3 years for the first time.
That was the first time you met her?
First time.
This was 3 years later?
3 years later at Ruth's Nursing Home on East 4th Street in East Providence, New York, Rhode Island. We go in, and here's this little lady. She's just sobbing and crying, and kept saying, "Why does he have to? Why did he have to go first?" It was then, late after a lot of digging and into the story, that I found that they'd been married in 1941 when he was 38 and she was 66, and they lived to celebrate their 25th wedding anniversary. She, the lady that she was, there was only one. In those days, nursing homes, maybe they still are, were in private homes, more so than in institutions as we know them today. People would develop these in residential areas and these houses, and nurses would care for these elderly people. And she was in a room with, I think, one or two others. There was only one chair in the room, and she said, Miss Whitehead, won't you be seated? I said, boy, she called him boy, love Washington and Lee, and he told me about your visits. I'm so sorry that I could not be there to greet you. And of course, we found out why he never let us meet her. He was afraid she would want to give the collection to Brown University, because she was the great-great-granddaughter of John Brown, and John Brown and his brothers, Brown University was named for. The Harrisoff side was that a man from Prussia came to this country in the late 1700s and married John Brown's daughter. He was heir Eshoff, and that became Harrisoff later. But he married John Brown's daughter, Sarah. And it was from that union that they had a son, and from that union there were nine children born. And they were the great boat builders of Providence. And her father, Mrs. Reed's father, was a talented chemist, founder of the American Chemical Society, wealthy.
Did you ever talk to her?
Yes.
About the paintings?
Never. I did not even know they existed. What happened was the day that I went up to sign the papers for the porcelain that was being packed, she was going to give it to us in her will, and then she changed her mind and said that she was going to give it to us right then, because she thought vandals, and this was at the height of the student unrest on college campuses, and especially at Brown and Rhode Island School of Design, it was pretty good. She was afraid they'd break in and just destroy it. So she said, I'm going to give it in my will. And so when I went up to sign the papers, there's this van that literally stretched from in front of the two houses. The mover, Mr. Lands, said, Mr. Whitehead, there's some old frames in the attic. Do you want them? And I said, well, if there's any room in the van, if you put the porcelain in, she said, we could have anything that his family did not want in terms of the art, of art. I didn't know. I just thought they were maybe just worthless frames. And he put them in boxes. Now, that was in April now of 1967. And they come to the university, they go into Cal Alto, all of the furniture and these boxes, and then the porcelain cartons went into the student union building in a basement. And I got a call right after we've gotten it down here saying, from the lawyer saying, Mrs. Reeves would like to have the sauce boat that belonged to her great-great-grandmother given to the Rhode Island School. And I said, oh my God. I said, please ask Ms. Reeves what room it was in. Fortunately, Everett Cotton had said what room it had come from, but did not say the contents on it. Well, he tells me, and it was in the little pantry. Well, there was in the third carton that I opened out of 200, we found the sauce boat. Then I'm walking across the campus, and I've never unpacked now those paintings. Never, they're all in those boxes. Walking across the campus, and this lady speaks to me, she and her husband, I assume it was her husband, walking across the campus, said, Mr. Whited, you don't know who we are. And I hate people that don't say, you don't know my name, do you? You don't remember me. I said, I just have to ask you. She said, I'm Mrs. Reeves' nurse. I said, yes, you're Mrs. whatever name was. And I said, how is Miss Reeves? She said, well, she's fine. She said, she's fine. She went up, we took her to the cemetery in Boston, where he's buried. And she was able to be taken out of the car, and she put 6 roses and 6 stones on his grave. I said, well, I'm sure glad. And they said, and how is the collection going? I said, well, we've just finished displaying a case in Lee Chapel. Would you like to see it? And I went down and I had, was not Pat Hindley, but somebody took pictures for me that could be, well, they were Polaroids. And I said, would you take these back to show to Mrs. Reeves? Because we'd promised her we'd put the most important items on view. And that's what we did in Lee Chapel when we had no other place to do it. So they go back. That was on Friday. They got back, or at least they got back up there on Friday. They show the pictures on Saturday, and she dies on Sunday. Now that's May. And not once did I ever know she was an artist. I talked to her about porcelain the whole time. Everything was about porcelain. That's all she talked about. And the only clue to the fact that she was an artist was at the nursing home when I'd go out to see her after he died, and I'd be up there with the lawyers and so forth. Bob Huntley was drew up all the legal papers and so on. He was still in the law school. She had a charm bracelet, and on that charm bracelet was an Eiffel Tower, a little Eiffel Tower. And I said, Ms. Reeves, and by this time I was calling a doll. I asked if I could call a doll, and she said, please. I said, doll, everybody else called a doll. I said, doll, tell me about the Eiffel Tower. She said, Francis gave me that. And Francis was Mr. Reeves' niece, who was teaching in Europe at one of the American schools. She had brought that Eiffel Tower charm bracelet back, and she was still wearing it. She was paralyzed on one side. But that was the only clue until the obituary came out, and it said that she'd studied with Raphael Collin and John Paul Lorenz, who were just, if you don't know, studying with Mr. Hostetter and Mr. whoever, who would have meant as much to me. But then one day I was over at the place, and I opened one of those boxes and pulled out this frame. It was glass on the frame. And literally, there had to be a quarter of inch of dirt and dust on that frame over the glass. And I thought I'd see a little steel engraving. I didn't know what I was going to see. And I wiped a wet old green towel. I wish I'd kept the green towel. Wiped it across that glass, and here was poppies. And I couldn't believe my eyes, which is like, and I've used the term years ago, it sounded a little silly, but it was like an explosion of color that came out of what I thought was just going to be absolutely nothing in terms of color. Then I picked, and the name on it meant nothing to me. It said Eden, I think it said, O-L-E. And I picked up another one, was totally different from that one. So I didn't know what we had. And I asked Marion Junkin, who was head of our art department, if he'd go over there and take a look with me. And he did. And he said, who did these? I said, I don't know. I know where they were, but I don't know who did them. But eventually, in working with them, I was able to determine that she had done them all and that she had been married for a short period, 3 months, only in 1910, left the man after 3 months, but his name was Eaton. She didn't like him, but she liked his name. He was a fourth cousin, I think. And But she, and I thought, oh boy, now I know how to date anything with an E or E. No, it has to come after 1911 when she was married to him. But that didn't work. She had gone back and put Eaton on things she'd done when she was a teenager. So, that's that.
Oh, we have got to continue this story.
No,
I have questions. No, another time. Another time. Oh, thank you.
All right.